her mouth and his cheek. It seemed to her that she ought to put him down again to make sure, but she knew she wouldn't be able to bear his crying. That was what had caused it in the beginning, his crying. He would start over something so trivial. The cat had been misplaced in this case, and his crying would wind on and on, endlessly on and on, growing into small shrieks that pierced her head. She had looked frantically for the cat, and then giving up, she had walked the baby up and down, trying to console him. It seemed to her that the crying would never stop. She was trapped inside the sound. The hour of the day and the day of the week drifted away, and she was trapped helplessly inside the sound of a baby's screams. She had picked him up once more to try to comfort him, but instead she had plunged him down onto the floor, plunging him again and again until his cries turned into hysterical screams. Then she had just sat beside him on the floor, dazed, gasping for breath, and gone at last to open a window. Coming back, she had seen him trying to get up. Now, as she held him in her arms, she knew she had never really hoped, not even in the night when she had felt quite calm, lying against her husband's back. She had never really hoped. As soon as she had seen him trying to get up, she had known that she had hurt him in some terrible way. Her life had shriveled as she watched him wallowing. She had never loved anyone as she had loved him, since she had first felt his first sensitive, tentative flutter inside her womb. She had been guiltily aware that she loved him more than she could ever love her husband, who was critical at times, and never really hers. But she had never hurt her husband except glancingly. She had never even scratched the surface of all the offensive strangers she had known. She had hardly ruffled her parents' composure, although she had hated them for years, and she allowed people to disturb and wound her without even frowning. It was the baby she had hurt. Still carrying him in her arms, she walked into the kitchen. Maria, the housekeeper, was standing at the sink filling the percolator with coffee. She watched it. She glanced at Jean, her eyes glassy and aglow. Jean stopped abruptly. The woman had no way of knowing, had been out of the apartment when it happened. Jean went to the high chair and propped the baby inside its arms. He was still as limp as string. She had to take his hands from his shoulder, her shoulder finger by finger, but this time he did not cry. He looked at her with his round, flat eyes, which she had never been able to penetrate, his happy eyes like buttons. He had always been a happy baby, and she had known it was at least partly because she mothered him well, flying to satisfy his demands, giving up her sleep and her freedom too willingly and gladly, as though they had never meant anything at all. "Will you give him his breakfast, please, Maria? It's so early, I'm going back to bed." In the hall, she thought, "I will wake up John and tell him what's happened, and he will tell me what to do." She opened the bedroom door, and the cold breeze from the window lapped against her ankles. Her husband, darkly bundled, lay in the middle of the bed. She stood with the doorknob in her hand, squeezing and turning it. It seemed to her that he must hear the sound and wake up, but he did not stir. She could not see his face, and she wished he would turn over so that she could at least see his eyes, which were generally kind, but he did not move. She had looked at him the evening before, intending to tell him, even imagining a scene with some tears but final comfort, looking at him. She had felt something fearful and cringing rise up inside her, authoritative too, as though it possessed the final wisdom. Do not tell him. No, never tell. No, never tell him. It was as though she had taken a lover, a foul, black passion, and must guard with all her strength against the relief of revelation. John had remarked that she was looking pale. She went out of the bedroom and closed the door. In the kitchen, Maria was talking to the baby. Jean listened to her soft, pattering voice. Borne along on the sound, she went to the front door and opened it. Maria will take care of him, she thought. He will be all right as long as he's with her. She rang the bell for the elevator. The morning paper was lying on the floor, crumpled, a fallen bird. She picked it up and laid it neatly on the bench. In the elevator, she realized she was not dressed and looked down at her short housecoat. It would pass. Only her slippers gave her away. She took them off and put them in her pocket. Outside, she felt the gritty pavement under her feet and was frightened. Dog filth and the litter from an overturned garbage pail lay along her way, smoking pyramids of dog filth, torn streamers of paper stained with hamburger blood. She placed each foot heavily, wondering how long it would be before she felt something wet. Crossing the street, she went into the park. The smoky morning sky lay along the tops of the trees. Looking up, she saw the sun burning a hole the size of a penny. The trampled grass, shaggy as an old dog's coat, was lifting a blade at a time. She remembered spreading the plaid wool shawl here for the baby and herding him in from the edges. His white shoes had been as clean when they went in as at the start. Walking a little farther, she reached a point where one path led to the interior. The path she always took with the baby stretched along the end of the street. The other, inside path was rutted from tree roots, and the only bench she could see had lost one of its legs. She had never hesitated before. The choice had been made for her by the sight of the baby's white bonnet, nodding like a peony inside the carriage hood. Now she took the broken path. It was very early. She had passed one man with a dog, but otherwise the park was empty. Empty, but edged with sounds and odd half-animate rustlings. She saw a squirrel move down a tree trunk with small, crippled feet. She stopped to look back, wondering what the animal expected. His tail was as thin as an old feather. His eyes, however, were shining, and she hurried on, remembering the crib animals at the rail. She thought she heard the squirrel coming after her on light, crippled feet, and turned to shout and wave him away. A small man, muffled in a coat, passed her quickly, his breath fanning her cheek. She was so startled she sat down on one of the broken benches. Above the tops of the trees, the apartment buildings raised their crenellated towers. She looked the other way and saw the little man, hurrying on his small feet, turn the corner and disappear. Awkwardly, she pushed herself up off the bench and followed. She was out of her territory at once. The plaid shawl had never been spread on these grassy places. She was astonished by the thickness of growth. Weeds, mosses, trees, the park abandoned had grown up like the backfields of a lost farm. Purple nettles, their heads as big as apples, stood at the edge of the path. The sidewalk, cracked and cracked again by shadows, ran in semicircles down into a little valley with a dry fountain, half full of leaves. At the edge of the pool, she stopped. A marble cupid, its flesh green with mold, raised an amputated elbow towards her. Its eyes were marked in the center by straight slits like a cat. Jean stood and waited. Under her feet, the warm sidewalk grew cool, and she imagined the green mold starting here and spreading around her like a shallow pool. The sounds of the city sifted through the leaves were as remote as summer thunder. She stood until her thighs began to ache, and then she sat down quickly on the lip of the pool. She knew that she was being watched from the trees, and she sat carefully, her short robe down over her knees. Staring into the leaf-filled pool, she showed the back of her neck bare and white, between her hair and the edge of her collar. As he watched from the shadow, he would catch the glint of white skin. Watching, she began slowly to freeze, until she knew that soon she would be unable to lift her hand. She moved her head slightly, adjusting it for the last time, and saw the cupid had a chain of beer can tops around his neck. As she waited, a blade of sunlight stretched slowly across the pavement, approaching her feet. After a long time, its point touched her toes, and she saw that she was shod in filth, only her insteps were still white. Revolted, she stood up. She had always hated dirt, any form of dirt, but public dirt collected from the feet of other people was intolerable. As she started purposefully back, she saw the trees coalesced around her, shrouding the small black hole where the path ran toward the street. Suddenly, she was afraid. Wishing could make anything happen, might already have set the disaster on its course. She stood prepared to defend herself and examined the ranks of trees. If he was watching, he must see that she was ready, her bare neck hidden now, her fists gripped. She remembered that he had been very small and thought that her assurance alone might quell him. But the wish, the terrible self-fulfilling wish for pain and mutilation, still hung in the air above her like a beacon. She knew that he would see it and understand that her defenses were only temporary. Panting, she began to walk slowly toward the entrance. Sweat ran down the insides of her arms, thick as honey. Her own smell, rank as the weeds, tortured her with its implications. Animals in danger give off a hot, rich stench. Moving carefully on lead feet, she began to believe that if she could reach the trees, she would be safe. It occurred to her to run, but remotely, dreamily. She kept repeating doggedly that she did not want anything to happen, although she knew that her doubt would flash through as soon as her bare neck had flashed, inviting the blow. Shadows fell over her as heavily. She had reached the trees. She panted. The trees were around her now, and she could no longer feel the weight of his eyes. He would be moving closer in order to keep her in view. Lifting her knees, she began at last to run, jogging clumsily, her breasts jerking. Her body inside the housecoat was as loose and thick as jelly, and she imagined her stomach dropping to her knees. Perhaps, if he saw that she had borne a child, he would spare her. At that, she began to run more quickly. Dashing, her flesh quickening, she left the shade of the trees. Below the embankment, a bus stopped and passed on. She could see the faces of the strangers at their windows, and she wanted to call and hold her hands out to them. Running down the slope, she nearly collided with a large woman leading a brace of hounds. The woman muttered and scowled as Jean stared at her. Jean crossed the street, skipping through a stream of cars, and heard their wild cries remotely. Her own building shone in a special patch of sun. She rushed in and flung herself into the open elevator. As soon as she opened the door of the apartment, she knew that she was too late. The smell of frying bacon still hung in the air, but the baby's dishes were heaped in the sink and his bib was lying like a fallen flag on the floor. She went from room to room, looking carefully, but she knew they had already gone. Sinking down on the kitchen floor, she fixed her eyes on the linoleum. The history of the apartment, replacing her life, streamed around her, and she wondered if anyone else out of the dozens who had lived there had ever crouched down on that kitchen floor. She remembered picking out the tiles. With much effort and indecision, she remembered her satisfaction as they were laid down. Now the bright blue was melting into the old tiles beneath it, and the floor was turning mud-colored again. She had imagined when they first moved here that she would make a life consciously chosen in every detail, and she had put her hand on her stomach to feel the baby's light kick, sure that this was the first great choice, and that the rest would follow. There had been a clear connection between the daisies she had arranged and her passion for her husband, between the pablum she had prepared and her love for the baby that had gradually grown and engulfed all the rest. "I loved him too much," she thought, "and that's why they've taken him away." Time passed. She heard the big electric clock draw its hand through several numbers. She did not dare to raise her eyes from the floor, and the back of her neck and her knees began to ache. She thought if they found her like that, kneeling, they might forgive her. When she heard the front door open, however, she sprang to her feet and screamed because of the cramped pain in her knees. "Jean," her husband called. She ran down the dark hall, which lengthened in front of her, a tunnel with their faces at the end. The baby, wrapped in a blanket, lay in the crook of Maria's arm. When he saw his mother's face, he began to cry, reaching out for her with both hands. Still too far away to touch him, she held out her arms, and her husband took the child and placed him in her hands. She did not dare to move him closer. She held him out at the ends of her arms, which trembled under his weight. John pressed the baby against her chest, and she saw Maria's face dark, without any smile. She turned to look at her husband. His hands, at her back and the baby's back, held them clamped together, but he was looking away. "He's all right, isn't he?" she asked softly. "It was just a bruise, wasn't it?" Neither of them answered. "Then what was it?" she asked, her voice rising. "The doctor couldn't find anything wrong," John said finally. "He examined him, but he couldn't find anything wrong." "But he couldn't walk. This morning..." she stopped herself. Maria lifted the baby out of her arms and set him on the floor. He stumbled forward, his hand stretched toward the gleaming doorknob. Jean sobbed. "It's all right now," John said, touching her arm. "But what happened?" John looked away. The gap of their silent understanding widened between them. Jean knew they would never speak of what she had done. The baby had reached the doorknob and was patting it with his hand.
My grandma and your grandma sit by the fire. My grandma said to your grandma, I'm gonna set your flag on fire. Talking about Hitler, Hitler, like a white girl. Check him off, you know, I'm not met. Check him off, you know, I'm not. Look at my king all dressed in red, like a white girl. Bet you $5 he'll kill you dead. Check him off, you know, I'm not. Talking about Hitler, Hitler, like a white girl. My black boy and your black boy sitting by the fire. My black boy said to your black boy, I'm gonna set your flag on fire. Talk about Hena, 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 like a white kuane. Check him off in a name. Check him off in a name. Check him off in a name.
Yeah.
The Bell Stars, Aiko Aiko, and Baby I'm Yours, sort of inadvertently played. I meant to play Melanie's Mama Mama in honor of this Day of Mothers, but the patch wasn't patched or something technical like that. You've been listening to Heresy, and I'd say so. My name is Sharon Griffiths, and this is WBAI 99.5 FM in New York, where I will be back next week. I am sandwiched in between Women's Day, which is on next Saturday, a day of women's programming, and Malcolm X's birthday celebration, which is there are massive chunks of programming on Sunday dedicated to that. So I, with the help of a dear friend of mine at work, have worked up a story or a presentation of a short presentation of the life of Malcolm X's mother, who was a tragic, very tragic woman, and he talks about her a bit in his autobiography, and I will be talking about her a little bit next week. I will be playing miscellaneous things. I will be asking you for money. Let me just tell you, a listener had called up and asked where I got these stories from. Faith, the first story I read, was by Ellen Wilbur, W-I-L-B-U-R, and it's from New Women and New Fiction. Faith, Fear, the second story, was by Sally Bingham. And I say New Women and New Fiction, edited by Susan Cahill, can be found at St. Mark's Books and Judith's Room. I must leave now. Thank you so much. I will be back next week. Thank you for pledging. The tally stands at $46,495. I've done my bit. Now you do yours. Thank you so much. See you next week.
WBAI in New York.
Some folks like to get away, take a holiday.
East Side, West Side, Lee Ryan knows his way, uptown and down. Tune in to Ryan's Only in New York, Sunday evenings, 6:30 until 7:30, right here on WBAI 99.5 FM.
On the Hudson River line. I'm in a New York state of mind.
It's 7:01 a.m. You've got your dial set to 99.5 FM WBAI in New York. Through the Opera Glass is a weekly feature of WBAI in New York. Today's host is Tony Koji and Regina Sokol. And now, Through the Opera Glass.
Thank you. Good morning and welcome to a special edition of Through the Opera Glass. This is our special marathon edition, and I'm here, Anthony Coggi, with our executive producer,
Regina Fiorito Sokol, saying good morning.
And we're going to be here to play lovely music, lovely operatic music, and at the same time ask you to pledge whatever you can afford to the WBAI fund. You can call 212-279-3400. That's 212-279-3400 to make your pledge to the WBAI fund. Without further ado, we'll start off with some music and something very quiet, perhaps, but certainly appropriate for this hour of the morning. We'll hear John McCormick, great Irish tenor, and he'll sing an aria from Handel's Semele, the aria Where Ere You Walk, a recording which dates back to 1936. The orchestra is conducted by Walter Gurr.
A
very quiet opening to our Through the Opera Glass performance this morning, our special marathon edition of Through the Opera Glass, and it's our May Membership Drive performance. The May Membership Drive is here, and we'd like to tell you that the number to call is 279-3400, with area code 212 just before that. That's 212-2400.